This is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter. And if you're listening on the same day that we're actually releasing this episode, Christmas Eve, and maybe feeling a little bit busy or stressed or hurried, you've definitely come to the right place. We had a wonderful chat with Rob Ray, one of the UK's, if not the world's, leading breathwork practitioners. And this conversation was not only incredibly useful, did you know this, for example?
80 to 90% of us are actually overbreathing.
Rob will explain everything. But the chat was also really enlightening too. Have a listen.
I think people can have psychedelic experience. In fact, I know they can because I've witnessed it, both as a practitioner and as a facilitator and a guide.
Plus, Sophie shares some of her experiences.
It's a very intense and active breath, and there's only one way I can think of to describe it, but when it hits your brain, it's like you're having an orgasm in your brain.
And Rob also does a guided breathwork protocol at the very end of the conversation. What a great episode to almost round off the year. We've got a fabulous futuristic one for next week, New Year's Eve. But for now, however you do or don't celebrate the holiday season, hopefully you can take a moment to just breathe and relax.
So today's conversation is with Rob Ray, a breathwork coach who works with all kinds of people from elite athletes and actors and musicians through to businesses, business leaders and everyday people who perhaps are possibly wondering what's all the fuss about with breathwork. Spoiler, you're not only about to find out, but if you stay with us to the end of this chat, Rob will guide us through an extremely powerful, very short minute breathwork practice to keep us really calm, which, considering we're releasing this episode on Christmas Eve, is probably perfect timing. Rob is a former model with a background in banking and is originally from Belfast, now living in London. But in terms of his story, everything changed on his honeymoon in Bali, which is when and where he first discovered the transformative powers of breathwork. I'm sure that many people have heard or read about stories where people say breathwork has changed their life, and Rob is certainly no exception. But as you're about to hear, there's breathing, something we all do every day, and then there's breathwork. Certainly on Rob's journey, he's taken in a range of different teachings and modalities, including, as he calls it, the dynamic world of stillness. I do want to add before we get into this chat that if you're a type A personality or somebody who struggles to switch their brain off and feels that perhaps breathwork isn't your thing, this conversation may well change your mind, especially as both Fee and I have also had quite profound personal experiences. Rob is based primarily in London, but he travels globally for workshops and one-on-ones, and he can also work with people online. Rob's been featured in everywhere from Vogue and Tatler to The Times, and you can book a session with Rob and find out more at robray, which is spelt robrea.co.uk. And do follow Rob on social media over on Instagram at robray__. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. What a lovely introduction.
What happened in Bali?
Gosh, what happened in Bali? Sounds like the start of a movie, doesn't it? Bali was 13 years ago now. Back then, my understanding of breathwork was what I would always say is my dad's current understanding of breathwork. It's just breathing, Rob. Why would I ever need to learn how to do it? It wasn't even that there was some sort of enlightened experience. It was really actually just the subtle nuance of what taking certain breaths in a certain way can actually do to the brain, then the body. So it was one of these things that I look back on 12, 13 years later and realize it's become more profound almost from the simplicity of the sensation and the feeling that I felt just coming in with no expectation, thinking initially that I was doing a yoga class. And then just being asked to breathe and follow the teacher's voice and cadence of breath to a point where he was making me hold my breath, close my eyes, feel sensations. And I suppose actually you said it there, I kind of entered into that dynamic world of stillness, which fascinated me really and led to me learning more and more about what on earth was actually going on inside my body.
We know that there are proven physiological benefits for breathwork, but rather than go through all the studies, which may be a bit dry, we're going to link to a few roundup articles in the show notes. But could you quickly recap some of the known data-supported physical benefits, especially some of the more unusual ones where data's maybe only just emerging?
The physiological benefits, thankfully, are now becoming very clear. Something that yogis and meditators and breathwork practitioners, maybe from the East, have known for tens of thousands of years is starting to become backed up by science. As you say, there's so many, and I don't want to go into a kind of chemistry and or biology session here, but the really exciting stuff from my point of view is how we can use the evidence and knowledge found in neuroplasticity and epigenetics, how it actually affects us on a biological level, but also on a psychological, psychosomatic level and a spiritual level. In particular, how we can use breath to kind of enter into that software upgrade of ourselves.
Hi, Rob. And that's of our brain, presumably, when you're talking about neuroplasticity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, as Sophie says, we're going to link into a whole bunch of articles and maybe a few studies if people do want to read them, because from what we've been researching, there's very little that breathwork can't impact positively. So it's a real pleasure to be talking to somebody like you who's really explored this at an expert level. But I guess as a partner question to what Sophie's just asked, could you also tell us what you've seen in practice in your classes, even if this hasn't necessarily been evidenced in studies? Basically, what personal stories and testimonies have you seen or heard? Because friends of mine report everything from increased sex drive to, which I think you're getting into, better mental health. It's astonishing what people are saying.
Yeah, that's quite right. I've really seen it all, it feels like. And that can come right down to having real skeptics walk in to do a session. Those people who think that breathwork is just breathing, and this idea that perhaps we can use the breath in a certain way to unblock or shift some emotional energy. You know, emotional memory, emotional information is stored in cells. And whenever we move that somatically, as in through the body, people can have huge emotional unblockage or release. And I don't mean to say that emotion is gone and gone forever, that trauma is gone and gone forever. But what I do mean is I've worked with people who hadn't cried for 15 years, and through using a certain breathwork technique and through some journaling and setting of the scene, let's say beforehand, there are a lot of emotions that come out. So I've seen people laugh, I've seen people cry, I've seen people come out saying that they've connected to a higher source or a higher version of themselves. Sex drive is one thing as well that has been reported back to me after working with people for a long time. That connection to themselves has led indirectly into a higher sex drive.
Super interesting. Over the years, so many different breathwork techniques have emerged, like holotropic breathwork, box breathing, Buteyko breathing, and also obviously the Wim Hof method. It seems there are as many different ways to breathe as there are foods to eat, and these different techniques will impact our bodies in different ways. I've heard it described as coffee, whiskey, and water, meaning we can use our breath to energize, to relax, or to balance. Can you give us an overview of the different types of breathwork, how they work, what they do, and do you have a favorite modality in your personal practice?
I love that. Coffee, whiskey and water. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Actually, that's a really lovely way to put it. I might steal that. Yeah, the way I look at it, I suppose, is through two lenses. Number one would be functional breathwork. And therefore, we'd be talking very much about how we're using breathwork to try to increase the efficiency within our body, to optimize our body, our physiology. And as you say, to maybe to relax ourselves whenever we want to go to sleep, or energize ourselves when we have to go to a social engagement, let's say. The other lens I look at it through would be this kind of transformative breath work, where the emotions can sometimes get unblocked or it can alter our state of consciousness. The functional stuff would be low intensity in its nature, and the transformative stuff would, for the most part, be high intensity in its nature. And that's probably a very simple way to explain, but breathwork in itself is just such a vast beast now, and it's becoming more and more so. So that might help to frame it in that way. And I haven't even mentioned pranayama in that answer, which is the yogic science of breath and body, of which there are hundreds upon thousands of different techniques which link into breath work. People would maybe suggest that all pranayama is breath work, but not all breath work is pranayama. Might be a good way to look at that. So that hopefully explores the lens through which I look at it.
I have a question for you, Soph. I know that breath work is part of your personal practice. What protocol do you use?
Yeah, so, well, I guess I use breath work in a few different ways. A lot of it linked to meditation. And we've talked before about Joe Dispenza's meditations, which I do a lot of. And before pretty much every meditation, I do a technique which he calls the breath, pulling the mind out of the body, I guess. And it's somewhat more aligned with, some people might describe it as being similar to Kundalini, where you're shifting energy up towards the brain using your breath, and it's a very intense and active breath. And there's only one way I can think of to describe it, but when it hits your brain, it's like you're having an orgasm in your brain. So very intense. And I also, if I'm doing a lying down meditation, will use quite an intense inhale, exhale type technique, which he calls the electric breath, but I know other people who use it in yoga practice as well. And then the other thing I'll do is during the day, if I've been hit by something that I find a bit stressful, I'll often use my breath to bring my heart back into coherence. And there are different ways of doing that, but I have a little heart math device that I might clip on my ear, or I might do something called a heart lock-in, but I really slow my breath down and breathe mindfully, and that brings my heart back into a coherent rhythm and relieves stress incredibly well. But yeah, I guess back to Rob, one thing that researchers seem to agree on is that we tend to overbreathe. So what's considered normal today is anywhere between 12 and 20 breaths a minute, with an average intake of about half a litre or more of air per breath. And for those on the high end of respiratory rates, that's about twice as much as it used to be. We also know that breathing too much can raise blood pressure, overwork the heart, and lull our nervous systems into a sense of stress. In fact, for the body to function at peak efficiency, we need to breathe as closely in line with our metabolic needs as possible. And for the majority of us, that seems to mean breathing less than we do. What are your thoughts on this, Rob? Because it seems we've become conditioned to breathe too much. Does it take a lot of retraining so that breathing less can become an unconscious habit?
Yeah, I love the way you framed that, particularly around breathing closely in line with our metabolic needs. That would be seen as functional breathwork, and it's important to say, because sometimes breathing through the mouth at quite a fast pace is needed because you're running a marathon or you're deep in an exercise that needs a little bit more oxygen in and carbon dioxide out. It's not a one size fits all that always just breathe through your nose and very slowly. But yes, absolutely, you're quite right. Probably 80 to 90% of us are actually over breathing at rest, and between 12 and 20 breaths a minute is seen as the average, and anything over 14, 15 would probably be classed in the category of chronic hyperventilation or chronically over breathing.
I wonder if that's linked to our busyness, modern day business, and modern day stress as a result of our business, maybe not.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. And this is where I think breath work isn't just biological. It comes, you know, it kind of uses biopsychosocial phrase, because so much can happen in our lives emotionally as well that changes our cadence of breath work and then becomes imprinted in our physiology. And then even though it's not necessarily good for us, our bodies are so smart that they make adaptations to make sure that we can survive on the daily basis. But of course, if that adaptation is maladaptive and it becomes a habit and it's habitually dysfunctionally breathing for 30 years, you're just right that all that kind of stress, that work, that extra work that the body's had to take on becomes problematic for your whole physiology.
At the time of recording, I've only just discovered breath work in the sense of taking it seriously. And I need to say that of all the wellness practices I've engaged with over the years, this is one that I really thought, going back to Soph, your intro, I thought I'd hate it, but it's turned out to be one of the most surprising ways I found a deep sense of calm. And it was Gary Brecker who convinced me that breath work is worth exploring, when he said he'd rather miss a flight than miss out on his morning breath work of everything he does. So I have, Rob, two big questions.
I was doing breath work on my flight last
night.
Were
you?
So,
oh.
Yeah.
This is fascinating how people say, of everything I do, this is the one thing that I will not miss. And I thought, I might take this seriously. Yeah. But I'm at the very start of this journey. So yeah, two beginner questions. Firstly, why do I find my toes tingling? Is it the nitric oxide? And secondly, in terms of technique, I found myself feeling really uncomfortable after a long breath hold. And when I release that breath, I really want to speed up the out breath and quickly inhale again. Is that normal?
I'll go back. The toes tingling, is that whenever you're doing high intensity breath work?
No, really slow, I think.
Okay,
yeah.
Beautiful. So whenever you're going much slower, what we're actually doing there is anchor into the present moment. Whenever we're anchoring into the present moment, you're slowing down your heart rate even more. You've mentioned nitric oxide. Yes, it's maybe an indirect pathway into toes tingling, but the nitric oxide, what that's doing is actually dilating your vessels, your veins, your arteries, so that blood can hit and be delivered to your organs more efficiently. Mm-hmm. Whenever we're doing this, we're essentially allowing the whole body to become more aware of what's going on. So the toes tingling in these types of scenarios would be probably indicative of a sense that you're anchoring into the present moment.
Grounding, I was going to say.
Absolutely, yeah, grounding. And it is actually, yeah. It's called your soma sensors, so your body sensors. Mm. They're actually being upweighted. Whenever we talked at the top about neuroplasticity, the idea of the brain changing, becoming more elastic, we're actually weighting our sensory perception higher than it normally is. Because usually if you're in a conversation, even now, you might not feel your toes tingling because you're focused on what I'm saying, or mm-hmm. if you're out about running for the bus, you're not necessarily counting how many dandelions you see on the pavement. And it's this idea that whenever we're grounding or whenever we're using breath as the object of focus, we are weighting in an upward trajectory our sensory perception, which is really exciting because actually it's a ratio. And the other side of that ratio is your priors, your past story, your past narratives. Mm-hmm. So if one is being pro-weighted, let's say, as in your sensory, your feeling of your air entering in the nose or your tingling of your toes, what's getting de-weighted is your past story about self. And this is where it links into well-being and mental well-being, because you start to create new priors based mm-hmm. on what you're feeling in the moment. So with the breath holds, whenever I work with free divers or with surfers, it's very much because we're trying to increase lung capacity and reduce the stress that we feel in the body whenever we hold the breath and be okay with the increased amount of carbon dioxide in the body. So it's almost like a top-down approach of trying to calm the mind in the moment, but also trying to use techniques to increase lung capacity. The other instance in which we would use breath holds are non-performance and simply to feel the body again. And this is where sometimes people can feel the tingles in their toes or feel more sensations in their body because they're entering into it to try to connect with the body. I sometimes don't even use the word hold. I would say pause. And I would say inhale gently and pause. And the pause could be 7 seconds, 8 seconds, but it's enough for you to feel into your body and then relax out. So I would suggest that if they start to get uncomfortable and you're doing it for performance, that's okay because you're doing it as a training. It's almost like a workout and a little bit of discomfort is never a bad thing in that scenario. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that if you're doing it for relaxation, to try to enter into meditation, you've gone a wee bit too far if you're starting to feel uncomfortable or looking to speed up your next breath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
You'd be surprised whenever we start to breathe in a certain way, how we can use the oxygen that is in the body to hold the breath. Very rarely do you need to breathe in again because you're lacking oxygen. The relationship is actually your relationship to carbon dioxide that makes you want to breathe in. Not mm-hmm. the oxygen levels, because the oxygen, you know, you're kind of 99% saturation of oxygen. You might, during a breath hold, go down to 96%. There is still so much oxygen in your body that you can make use of. But actually, it's the relationship and the tolerance to carbon dioxide that you have that creates the panic, which is why there's such a huge link between carbon dioxide tolerance and stress, and can you start to be okay with carbon dioxide in your body, can often lead to, I can actually handle more stress. There's a stress resilience work.
From what I've read, scientists don't know exactly how slow deep breath promotes relaxation, but many believe its ability to increase HRV is key. So HRV, heart rate variability, I've spoken about quite a bit before. And as a quick listener explainer, in very simple terms, when we breathe in, our heart beats momentarily faster to speed the flow of oxygen around the body. And when we breathe out, our heart slows down. And HRV is the difference between these two rates. So a higher HRV is seen as a marker of the body's stress resilience. Rob, can you build on my explainer by talking about the parasympathetic nervous system, the vagus nerve? Because as I understand it, the higher a person's HRV, the greater the strength of their vagus nerve and the quicker the body can activate its response to stress.
You've got this vagus nerve, which is one of the kind of 10 to 12 cranial nerves coming out from the brain. It's called vagus because it's like a wandering, from the Latin, to wander, essentially. A wandering nerve, or actually it's two nerves that connect into a lot of the vital organs in your body. The vagus nerve itself makes up like 75%, I believe, of the parasympathetic system. Like, parasympathetic basically just means rest and digest. It's that feeling you have on a Sunday afternoon after having a big Sunday roast and you're a wee bit sleepy on the sofa, or, you know, you've just finished the massage and you're feeling really woozy almost and you're just ready for relaxation. That's a good indicator that you might be in parasympathetic state. Now, the autonomic nervous system has another branch known as the sympathetic state, and this is nothing to do with sympathy and everything to do with fight or flight. And it's not necessarily a really bad thing. We do need to be able to, let's say, increase up our sympathetic tone in order to sometimes, back in the day, it was running away from a tiger. Today, it's maybe presenting on stage, or it's going into an important meeting, or it's playing a sport at a high level. You're most probably going to be in a kind of sympathetic tone. HRV within this framework and within this context relates to the ability to move between your sympathetic, your parasympathetic branches of the nervous system. And let's say a high HRV would suggest that the person has resilience in their body to be able to be in a sympathetic state, but then come back down to parasympathetic state when they need to. So the idea with the vagus nerve within this is that the vagus nerve makes up 75% of the parasympathetic state. So the more that we understand how we can activate or stimulate this vagus nerve, the more that we can almost press a button within the nervous system to say, we want you to go into rest and digest, to relaxation. And this is really important because, I suppose, again, going back to the day, you wouldn't have been checking this little device in your pocket that was sending through emails and other people's thoughts and asking you to do various different things, which are seen as stressors, visible stressors, let's say. And there's a whole different conversation to be had, I think, on hidden stressors, but I'll keep it on the visible stressors. The telephone, the air that we breathe, the food that we eat, they all impact our nervous system. And it, for the most part, unfortunately, it's heavily weighted towards us staying in a sympathetic state.
I noticed on your website that you mention integrating breath work, meditation, and also somatic techniques. I'm curious to know what these somatic techniques are.
I love this question. So the somatic techniques for me are all somatic experiencing to take me into the space that I'm in right now. And that is, if you think about what anxiety is, or regret, it's anxiety living in the future almost. Your awareness, your intention is on what is going to happen in the meeting next Tuesday. Or regret or shame or guilt is very much living in the past and thinking and replaying in your mind's eye the things that you should or could have or would have done differently in a scenario. And somatic experience, soma is the Greek word for body. So this is, you might hear this a lot in the kind of wellness space and certainly in the breathwork space. It's kind of body techniques this would refer to, and yoga can be seen as a somatic technique. I use with my clients shaking, bouncing, acupressure, self-massage, tapping. And all these things are to stimulate the fascia in the body to connect to the present here and now. And it gives you that reference point of how does my body feel in this moment. For me, sometimes it's an intuitive practice that, like stretching is, like any self-massage is, you come across a point in your body where you either feel a little bit of tension or you feel, oh, there's something nice about rubbing the side of my neck in that way. And it's very, very calming. It goes right back to us as babies being held and connected. So these are all self-soothing, in which integration of emotions and breath work comes into it.
And if we bring it back to technique, if we want to create a sense of calm, where are we breathing from, like ideally? And can you also talk about the inhale versus the exhale and the nose breathing versus the mouth breathing? Because it's really reassuring to hear you say it doesn't always have to be nose breathing, because I've been obsessively nose breathing at all times when I remember. And can you also describe this in reverse? So, for example, if you want to feel energized, so the whiskey version and then the coffee version of how you breathe.
I actually really like to think of, whilst physiologically, the idea would be that you breathe deep down into your abdomen, into your belly, and really try to feel the sides of your ribs opening to the sides and lower back opening backwards and the belly opening frontwards, you know, almost like a horizontal breath work rather than a vertical. I like the idea of, for calming and for reassurance, breathing to and from the heart center space. In a lot of spiritual traditions, the heart center would be seen as the center of consciousness, not necessarily the place behind the eyes, the brain, where other traditions might say the center of consciousness is, but behind the heart. And I've anecdotally, I must say, across the clients that I work with, we work a lot with heart-centered meditations and heart-centered breath works to really start to feel calm. So I think there's something that you can do within the visualization and awareness within that and breathing from and to. With regards to the inhale versus the exhale, I'd suggest, and literature suggests, that an elongated exhale is the best way to bring calm to the body. So yeah, your inhale it speeds the heart up. It helps pump blood around the body. And the exhale essentially does the opposite. It slows the heart down, and it's a beautiful duality of life. And you can even think about that in terms of inhale is your sympathetic state and exhale is your parasympathetic state.
And it's actually, because I'm not a free diver, but I dive and I love scuba diving, and that's exactly what I do when I scuba dive. I will take a short inhale and then I'll take, so say, a 2 second inhale, and then I'll breathe out for at least 6 seconds. And I love the fact that all it is me, my breath and the beautiful nature around me, but it also really calms me down, reduces my gas consumption, and so I can dive for longer. Win-win.
Yeah, it's total win-win. I absolutely love that.
How do you feel about mouth taping, Rob?
It's not sexy. me and my wife together 13 years and we've done the whole mouth taping stuff. It does work. Not sexy, does work, I would suggest. But it is absolutely amazing. I went, you know, we're talking about a 3 millimeter tape, so very thin, that goes across the middle of your mouth. We're not talking about something that really, sometimes people hear that mouth taping and they're like, oh my goodness, I'm going to drown if I do that, especially asleep. You're not. It's the idea is that you've got 3 millimeters of tape across the middle part of your mouth. And if you need to, your mouth will open during the night. But it's like an unconscious retraining of your breath pattern. I loved the fact of feeling really deeply nourished after a night sleep where my mouth hadn't gaped open. Usually, you know, if your mouth has been open during sleep, it will be very dry whenever you wake up. That's a big telltale sign, or you'll feel pretty rotten whenever you wake up. I like the idea of mouth taping during sleep. I now work with some sports people who are using it during training, and it's phenomenal for that. Now, this is control work, it would be termed as, and it can be pretty intense to use a mouth tape for a tennis player whenever they're really trying to run around the court and breathe. So it's something that kind of you don't do the week before competition and you don't start it during competition. But it's something that I would definitely, for most of my sports people, I would put it into a protocol over a 6 month period where they start to get used to taping the mouth. It also has that beautiful impact of an impact on stress. Carbon dioxide and stress are hugely linked in the literature.
We're going to have to put some links on mouth chafing in the show notes as well. You've touched on this, you've both touched on this. Sophie, you've touched on this separately to this conversation. So let's ask the question, can a person really have a psychedelic experience from breath work? Sophie, do you want to chime in on this one? Because I know this is something that you feel quite strongly about.
Yeah, and do you know, this is something I've not tried. I'm very curious too. I know that a New York Times story looked into the potential therapeutic applications of holotropic breathwork and whether this can create an altered state of consciousness. And I think it's important to say that in other cultures, shamans and swamis have used breathwork for thousands of years. So this is nothing new. Interestingly, someone called Stanislav Grof is considered to be one of its earliest advocates. And he was also involved in a lot of the studies on LSD and the idea that hallucinogenic drugs can help with trauma and psychotherapy. But when the FBI began cracking down on drugs like LSD, he switched his attention to something you can't be imprisoned for, breathing. Mm-hmm. And some studies have shown that certain fast-paced techniques have created a feeling that's similar to psychedelic experiences. But interestingly, as yet, scientists don't know exactly why this is. Maybe increased oxygen flow can heighten the senses and create that psychedelic effect. But as I say, with so many of these things, there are more studies needed. I think that there are many different ways that similar endpoints can be achieved, whether that's through meditation techniques, breathwork techniques, or in countries where it's legal, psychedelic drugs. But I'd be really interested to hear Rob's experience on this.
100% in answer to your question. I think people can have psychedelic experience. In fact, I know they can because I've witnessed it, both as a practitioner and as a facilitator and a guide. This is really, really exciting research that's going on at the minute that I'm involved with as well, with neuroscience psychologists and respiratory scientists, to understand what is happening. And I think there's a beautiful intersection here across neuroscience, psychology and biology. Whenever we're breathing in a certain way, what we're doing is changing our physiology. We're changing blood gas ratio and we're changing the cadence with which we're breathing. Whenever we're doing that, we're actually causing an error in our prediction. So this is where it gets really, really exciting, because this error in prediction allows new learning to come through. So I think it goes back to this idea of it deweights your prior experiences because they're not as important for you right in this instance. Whenever a new experience and a new somatic experience is happening for you, so you're breathing in a certain way, you start to become less worried about the story that you tell yourself or that you understand about life, because essentially your body has to deal with the here and now of there's something different happening in my body that doesn't happen every single day. That's really, really cool, because you've got two choices in that moment. And I've seen this with clients in both group work and in one-to-one work. Your choices are, number one, gosh, this is opening up a door into the unknown and I would rather not open up this door. So I'm going to close my mouth, leave the room and say, thank you so much, Rob. I never want to see you again. Mm-hmm. Or your other choice, I suppose, is, gosh, I'm going to let go into this experience and just see where it takes me. People then experience these realizations that they wouldn't have had in a conscious thinking brain state. They've wired people up with EEGs to understand what's even happening on a brainwave basis. And the brainwaves are moving into gamma wave and out of your theta or alpha, beta brainwaves, which is amazing that just through the breath, you're able to access this part of your brain that might not have been accessible. I've spoken to a physio who has been working on someone's lower back or hip and they got a knot out and the person started crying because that emotion kind of left. And it's these types of things that sometimes we can't do to ourselves unless you ingest something. That is really exciting within this particular breathwork space, because we are starting to put the neuroscience and the biology around it, and it is a very exciting space to be right now.
So finally, would you please guide us through a very quick pre-Christmas breathwork journey designed to keep us calm so we can feel it in practice?
I certainly can. So close the eyes down if you feel safe to do so. Try to make yourself into a straight spine position, whether that's sitting on the seat or lying on the floor. Take a normal breath in through the nose and then release out through the mouth. Good. In through the nose and then long out through the mouth. We're going to do 4-4-8 breathing, which means we're going to inhale for 4, hold for 4, and exhale for 8. Whenever you feel ready, I want you to follow me for the next 90 seconds. Inhale, 2, 3, 4, hold gently. And then exhale through the mouth for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Inhale gently through the nose. Hold it gently just for 4, 3, 2, 1, and then slowly out of the mouth. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Inhale slowly through the nose. Sip the air in. Pause gently at the top. Try to relax the shoulders down. 3. And then exhale out of the mouth. Doing really well. Into your last one. Inhale for 4. Hold for 4. And exhale for 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Good. Just come gently in through the nose. And then long, slowly out of the mouth and relax the shoulders on the exhale. 2 more like this, in through the nose. Try to feel the air entering at the nose. Exhale through the mouth, long and slow, and relax the body on that exhale. Last one, in. And long and slow out. You can gently blink the eyes open, maybe move the neck, move the shoulders. Take a moment to come back into the space and just notice what maybe was that 70 or 80 seconds of breath work can do to your day.
Everyone can find time for that de-stress in their day.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I wish we could do that all afternoon. It's really, really nice. Thank you so much, Rob.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rob, for coming on.
Thank you.
That ends our podcast. If you want to explore more of what we talked about, simply head to the show notes. We've done all of the research and noting down of names, ideas, any studies we mentioned, so you don't have to go digging. To be ahead of the latest episode, press follow on Apple Podcasts. That's the little cross on the top right. Or simply hit follow on Spotify or whichever podcast app you use. Also, do follow Sophie on Instagram and TikTok. There's loads of great content and little explainers on there. Search for Dr. Sophie Schotter. Finally, if you're close to London or Kent, you can book a consultation with Sophie and find out more about who she is and the range of treatments and services she offers via drsophieschotter.com. And by the way, there's some great blog content on the website too. My name's Fiona Mattesini. On behalf of myself and Sophie, please do take a moment to rate and review the show. It all helps. And of course, thanks for listening.